You are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM. You have reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, coming to you every Thursday at lunchtime. Today we have on a wonderful, wonderful show with a variety of different guests, and I will introduce them in a moment. We're going to be talking about the slow food movement and traditional foods. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. And you can find out more about our radio show, Reality Sandwich, at realitysandwichradio.com. And you can listen to this show and all past shows from that website. So today I have on several guests. I have on Sandor Katz, who is joining us by phone. He is the author of Wild Fermentation and The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved. And he is what he calls a fermentation fetishist. We also have on Taylor Bedeker, who is the owner and charcutier, boy, of The Fatted Calf. And he makes all sorts of artisan, handmade, high-quality meat products and wonderful sausages and things, and we'll get into all of that. And we have on Carla Borelli, who is a San Francisco foodie, health nut, and author and founder of a blog called Local Forage, and it's all about focusing on high-quality foods and traditional foods. And, of course, I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant who's coming at this subject from the perspective of nutrition and health and the importance of high-quality food in our food supply and our diet on a daily basis. So let's see if I can get Sandor on the line here. One moment. Sandor, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Great to have you.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So before we get started, I just want to kind of have each person go through a little kind of overview of who they are and how they got involved in all of this. So since maybe we have Sandor, we have you on the phone, maybe you could start with what your interest is in all of this and how you got started and whatever else you want to tell us.
Well, sure. I mean, the way this all got started is that I am a person who loves to tinker in the kitchen and who loves to tinker in the garden. And my intersecting interest in growing food and eating food led me to learn about fermentation. And, you know, I'm really mostly self-taught from books. Although, you know, since I wrote a book about fermentation, which is called Wild Fermentation, The Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods, and I have a website, which is wildfermentation.com, and my book was published almost 4 years ago, and that has and it led me into a lot of traveling around and teaching workshops and learning how intimidated many people are by fermentation and fearful that, you know, any food that is left to age and mature outside of refrigeration could make people sick. And so, you know, essentially what I feel like I'm doing is demystifying ancient rituals that, you know, human beings and cultures have been practicing since the beginning of time, but that we, you know, like other aspects of food production, we have sort of lost our power as it has disappeared behind factory doors, and people have come to fear a process which is very central to good nutrition, to preserving food from seasons of plenty, to eat during seasons of relative scarcity. And teaching people about fermentation has really brought me into contact with people who are passionate about many different food movements, you know, including, you know, not only slow food, whole foods, traditional foods, raw foods. You know, there are so many, you know, really exciting food movements that are happening, and fermentation, you know, I would say sort of lies at the intersection of them. And I've met so many fascinating people involved in really exciting projects as I travel around teaching about fermentation that I actually wrote another book inspired by food activists that I've been meeting, and it's called The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, Inside America's Underground Food Movement.
Great.
But, you know, still I'm really just a guy who likes to putter in the garden and putter in the kitchen, and I am an experimentalist. And, you know, I think that the biggest thing we need to be reviving is participation in food production.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sustainability is not a spectator sport. Participation is sustainability.
Well, thank you, Sandor. It's great to have you on, and I have two wonderful recipes I've been making for years now, your kombucha and your sauerkraut, so we'll probably get into some of that as we go. And I wanted to have Taylor go ahead and introduce himself and what he does and how he got into all of this.
Hello. My name is Taylor Bedeker. I'm one of the owners and one of the production heads of the Fatted Calf Charcuterie based here in San Francisco. Basically, overall, what we do is we do a lot of traditional Western European charcuterie with an emphasis on small batch, handmade, very high quality, no fillers, no junk. We are very aggressive in our sourcing of all of our raw products. We get as much as possible from local farmers. We participate in two farmers markets a week at the Ferry Building in San Francisco and also in Berkeley on Saturdays. We're also the Tuesday Ferry Building market. We have different sources for all of the lamb, beef, and pork that we buy. You know, of highest importance pretty much is that it's all pasture raised. It's fed with natural feeds, no antibiotics, no hormones. And generally that, you know, our belief is that an animal that's raised, you know, in proper circumstances is going to be easier on the environment. It's going to be a lot healthier and is ultimately going to taste better as well. Keeping that in mind, we make a lot of traditional type items. We make everything from bacon to beef jerky to, you know, highfalutin fancy pâtés and terrines. But pretty much with the emphasis on, you know, starting over every week. Small batches, you know, that we really can focus on instead of just making huge runs of things, stamping a sell by date and then just tossing it out, you know, for people to, you know, fend for themselves over.
Mm-hmm.
So that's generally what we do and who we are. We're a very small company. We're here in San Francisco right now. Sometime this summer, we're going to be moving up to the Napa Valley into a storefront and building of our own. So
great.
That's the next big step forward.
Great. Yeah. And before I introduce Carla, let's just take a moment and just talk about how much we love Taylor's Crepinettes.
Oh, I must have them every week.
I know.
I cannot live without them.
So good. Why don't you describe the Crepinette for those who have never had them?
Well, the Crepinettes are pretty much, they're sausages just wrapped in a different natural casing called crepine. It's also known as caul fat, but, you know. French version sounds a little bit better. Basically, what we do is we make a basic filler, basically of a duck or pork or lamb or any combination thereof, and then we add a garnish to it. And that garnish is usually dictated by what we see at the market that looks good. Like this week, it's herbette chard with melted onions and pine nuts and lemon zest. It varies. I mean, you know, when wild mushrooms are in season, we try and use as many of those as we can.
Are we going to lunch at your house after this?
I have loads and loads of work to go to. I'll take it up next time. Absolutely. But yeah, we make a different kind every week, and they are one of our biggest sellers. Mm. They're very popular.
Very tasty and absolutely delicious.
Thank you.
All the products are.
So, Carla, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
So, I'm Carla Borelli, and I started a food blog about 9 months ago called Local Forage, which is a blog promoting traditional foods, not only as a gastronomic pleasure, but also a very necessary element of good health. And my background is that, first of all, I come from a totally food-obsessed, huge Italian family, where everything revolved around food, and which is also a culture of traditional foods. And it's really interesting because, you know, I had been eating fermented tomatoes for most of my life, and but it wasn't until I read Sandor's book and actually started experimenting with fermented foods that I actually understood as far as I was concerned, my parents just kind of pulled it out of a, you know, bell jar, but I didn't really know what the process was. Mm-hmm. So it was really cool to kind of get that background and understand that I had actually been eating fermented foods forever. So that's one piece that, you know, I just come from a culture that's very food focused. And then the other piece is that about 10 years ago, I had a sort of personal health crisis. And food was a very integral part of my healing process. And I had to do, basically, I had a form of chronic fatigue that was pretty much impossible to diagnose, and I had to seek alternative therapies. And no one could really tell me what was wrong or how to help. And so it really was a project that I had to undertake to really figure out what was wrong with me and find the right people to help and do things like start a diet that was very different from what I had been using before. And a lot of that has to do with traditional food. So my blog is really kind of a labor of love. I just want to share this information with people.
Mm-hmm. And it is so full of fascinating information. And we're actually talk about some of those stories today, because stories go up every day and I can barely stay on top of all the wonderful things. So you can find Carla at localforage.com, and you can find Taylor at fattedcalf.com. That's FATTEDCALF.com. And then Sandora had mentioned wildfermentation.com. And of course, I'm at healthfulliving.org. So just to start our conversation today, I wanted to just give a little bit of background. I thought we could talk about the slow food movement and traditional food, since that's really what most of us have in common, which is a passion for the healthiest, best tasting food for humans, the environment, the animals, and everything associated with it. And so the slow food movement really, I believe it might have been actually started in Italy. It's a around the world movement, and it was really created to sort of oppose the fast food movement. And it really, it was created to do things such as explain and provide an alternative to fast foods and highly processed convenient food, convenience foods. It's stating and explaining all of the negative things around agro-business and factory farms and focusing more on the local farms. It's really highlighting the negative pieces around monoculture farming and genetically modified foods and pesticides and all of those things, as well as the additives and all of that. And from there, they came up with the slow food movement, which is about going back to traditional ways of cooking, all of that traditional wisdom that we knew, getting the raising the best quality animals for human health, as well as plants and ways of getting good nutrients that way, preserving seeds and understanding the importance of having variety within our agriculture supply, looking at small scale processing, local foods, not transporting foods from long distance, family farms and gardening and all of those wonderful pieces. So with that, I wanted to just start by maybe throwing out a question of, maybe let's just talk about foods. And most people think of doing a good thing for their family by getting the least expensive food they can, because of course we all, most of us have budgetary concerns. And so we feel like we're doing a really positive thing by being conservative with our cash and saving it and really buying the least expensive food we can. Most of that is because people don't understand what it really takes to produce high quality food, and that there's a difference between the quality of the cheap food and the expensive food beyond just the price, significantly beyond just that. And so where should we start? Maybe Sandor, I don't know, Sandor,
I
know.
Address that a little bit.
Great.
You know, I think that, you know, certainly, you know, given the agricultural subsidy systems that are in place in our country, you know, right now, you know, in America, it is possible to, you know, eat an adequate number of calories for less money than it than you know, sort of anywhere ever. Less money, you know, proportionate to average household income. When I was finishing up my book, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, an item appeared in our local small-town Tennessee newspaper that declared the first week of February was National Food Checkout Week. And it's because by the fifth week of the year, the average American household has earned enough money to feed itself. Less than 10% of average income and aggregate income is going towards food. I think it's very interesting when we're talking about how we are nourished to compare that figure with the amount of money that people spend on health care. And around the time when I was born in 1960, people were spending, the average household and the economy as a whole was spending 3.5 times as much money on food as on health care. Since that time, we have spent progressively more money on health care and progressively less money on food. 1989, those lines crossed, and people were spending the same amount on food as on health care. Today, people are spending more than 50% more on health care than on food. I think the question we need to be asking is, are these phenomena related? Is the quality of the food that we're eating, with pesticides, with hormones, with genetically modified ingredients that we don't understand, with the radiation, is this sort of, cheap food really serving our interests, or do we need to invest in our health, in our family's health? The answer seems fairly obvious to me that, the quality of the food that we eat has something to do with, all of these emerging epidemics. And that, if we would pay more attention to eating higher quality food, which would involve a greater expense, that it would be a worthwhile investment.
Thank you for that. That's really important because I know my husband lived in Japan he lived in Japan as well as my brother did, and they spend far more on food than we do, and most people just don't really understand that it makes a big difference in the quality that you're getting to make food that cheap. We shouldn't be wondering why are some foods so expensive, but how can you make these foods so cheap? And I'm wondering if maybe Taylor can talk from the perspective of just an example of some of the meats, the salamis and sausages and things that are out there. What is different about yours, and how does that compare to what you would normally find in an average grocery store?
Yeah, and this all kind of relates to this concept of the high price of low cost.
Mm-hmm.
So, Taylor, I'd love to hear what you have to say about that, because certainly your products are not low price.
They're not. One of the things we say around the kitchen a lot, and also I tell a lot of our customers at the farmers market, is that there's really no such thing as cheap meat. The meat, especially the economic and ecological implications, as well as everything that all the subsidies like Sandra was talking about, and everything that has to happen in order for a huge company to sell processed weird bologna in lots of plastic and cardboard and packaging, everything that has to happen up until then, if people really saw the whole picture, I think that a lot of people would really reevaluate the way that they think about eating and feeding their families, and take a look on the back of the package. I mean, we're talking about high fructose corn syrup beforehand. It's just kind of amazing to see how many things it's worked its way into, and you kind of have to wonder why.
Mm. It's cheap.
Well, exactly, and a lot of low quality cheap meat, especially so called cheap meat, is it's actually the end result of a long series of bad things, from the way the animals are raised to the way that these things are processed and put together. I mean, it astounds me. It's completely not, it's not natural, and it doesn't seem right that something should buy something that will hold for a year. Mm. I mean, especially when you're talking about meat. I mean, certain things are naturally fermented and cured, the salamis and things like that. But when they've been injected with water and all kinds of like unnatural curing agents and things like that, it just
nitrates.
Yeah, which used judiciously are, and I'm sure Sandra could probably speak to this better than I could, but they're naturally occurring in nature. You salt certain things, and there are naturally occurring nitrates and nitrites in lots of different things, spinach, mm-hmm. cabbage, all other kinds of vegetables, but. Mm-hmm. And basically the end result of it, though, is that they can sell these things for, you know, a fraction of the cost of what we were able to, because, you know, their interest in most of the companies who produce these things, their interest is not in providing you with a high quality, healthy product. It's in making money and trying to get you to believe that, you know, this is what's best for you. And like Sandra was taking, you have to, participatory exercise. You have to get involved. You can't just, you know, cede all your control over what you eat to, you know, grocery stores or corporations or whoever else.
Corporations that are really, you know, mostly concerned with their stockholders.
Their bottom line. They're not interested in your health.
Right.
And the way, you know, the way that we do things is pretty much the opposite side of the pendulum. You know, not just from how we, you know, we make our, you know, we source all our ingredients and how we make everything. I mean, we don't add a lot of cheap filler and water into things. We process things as minimally as possible. I mean, we have a small, tiny little smoker. Name's Mary Kate. She's very sweet. But we work her to death. And, you know, that's pretty much how we preserve things. It's a much smaller operation, and it's the kind of thing that I think, for one thing, not everyone needs to eat, you know, meat or processed meat every day. Mm-hmm. You know, I try and tell, you know, customers of mine a lot, like, I'd rather you come back next week and get a small amount than, like, you know, stock up this week.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, people don't need to be eating sausage or pate or bacon or ham every day. It's you know, it's not natural. It's not good for you. So, I mean,
I when I get your pate, the duck liver mousse, I eat it every day until it's gone.
Well,
so I'm really bummed out to hear that, Taylor.
I'm sorry. And it's probably, you know, it's not probably in my own best economic interest for me to say that.
That's
but,
right.
You know, in the interest of someone who does, you know, care, you know, I have a pretty, you know, pretty tangible relationship with most of my customers. I know, you know, a lot of their habits and how, you know, how they like things. You know, when we make certain things, they'll try and hold on to them for certain people. And I think that, you know, when that's pretty
mm-hmm.
much,
yeah.
That's pretty much how I feel about the whole cheap food.
Mm-hmm. So what about though, you know, families who really can't afford these foods, is it then, you know, is it just a matter of eating more moderate quantities of these things? Because not everyone can afford these organic, you know, artisanally produced foods. And that always comes up for me. It's like,
right.
I try to be really careful on the blog of talking about this stuff and saying you should do this.
Absolutely.
Because, you know what, not everyone
mm-hmm.
can. And we are really privileged to be able to afford these kinds of super high quality
right.
products.
Well, something like what I do, I'll make no bones about it. What we make is a luxury product. It's
mm-hmm.
not going to be something that everyone can afford to eat, especially not all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking about your basic needs for survival, you know, grains, vegetables, fruits, you know, my brother lives in outside the Twin Cities in Minnesota. He's got three different CSAs to choose from. They're springing up all over the place. I think CSAs are a really good way to go.
And that's community supported agriculture.
Absolutely.
A vegetable produce box.
Yeah, basically you sign up, you pay a nominal fee every month, and they drop a box of veggies on your door every week. It's
mm-hmm.
fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Another local food blogger is working on getting a meat CSA up and running. It's called Ethicurian.com.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They do a fantastic job over there. They're really good at keeping on top of what's going on with FDA and USDA rulings,
mm-hmm.
The whole irradiated meat and cloned meat
mm-hmm.
Debacle, you know, and everything that comes up. They really dig through a lot of the things that, you know, these government institutions would rather we really not know about, rather
right.
just keep going about our daily lives
right.
and say thank you.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a concept, though. I've never heard of a meat CSA. Are people doing that in other areas of the country?
I don't think it's really being done all that much. I think they're kind of pioneering the way. But basically what they're trying to do is, you know, source meat from local farms, local organic farms like Marin Sun Farms. There's another pork ranch up in Marin that they're trying to use.
Clark Summit.
That's the one, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Clark Summit,
yeah.
Liberty Farms,
mm-hmm.
Duck,
mm-hmm.
you know, and trying to work with them so that they can, you know, try and work some kind of system out.
Sure.
We'll see where it goes.
I have mm-hmm. a comment for your question, Carla.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell clients that, firstly, traditional foods had 10 times the levels of certain fat-soluble vitamins like A and D. So just simply the way you take care of an animal, like Taylor was saying, significantly increases these levels, as well as when you start doing low-fat everything, you start taking even more of these out. Mm-hmm. So you can't really make up for these nutrients in quantity. So I would much rather see somebody eat a small quantity of this pate or raw cheese or pastured eggs and get a little bit of it rather than not do any of it, because you really can't make up for it.
Well, you know what? That's a good point. The other thing that I noticed in eating these foods is that I really don't require as much. Like when I eat meat, I eat a really small, you know, piece compared to what, it's like my body just says that's all you need. You're sated. It's almost like my body realizes that there's enough nutrients in a smaller piece.
Yes, exactly.
It's very interesting.
It is really interesting. So,
can I jump in at all?
Please.
Oh, okay, great. I wasn't sure if y'all were hearing me. So I just want to say that meat. See, the community supported agriculture model, which farmers love because it enables them to not put all of their effort into marketing. They can take care of their farm, but people are applying that concept to meat, to milk, even to I've heard of a beans and grain CSA style farm.
Super.
And I think that people are applying this model to other other things besides vegetables, absolutely. And I think some of it is a little bit under the radar because outside of California, raw milk is mostly illegal. Although a lot of these are structuring themselves as cow or goat shares, so that the shareholders in the CSA actually own the animals. And pay the farmer for the service of caring for them and milking them on their behalf.
So that's kind of a loophole, huh, Sandor?
Yeah, it's people. It's people finding ways to work around the laws and get their needs met.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say another thing about obviously there are many, many people who are struggling to get their to live on the money that's available to them, and so you can't. Blame people for not having disposable income to spend on foods. And, we need to look at, big macro social issues. Like, right now Congress is debating what they call the Farm Bill, but which, I'm taking Michael Pollan's lead and calling it the Food Bill, because it's not just relevant to farmers. It's relevant to the food that all of us eat. And so, there's all of this junky soy and corn-based food system that includes the animal food, the mainstream animal foods, and most of the processed foods in a supermarket. And if the subsidy system were transformed so that we weren't making those the cheap foods, we could certainly, as a society, be subsidizing foods that are more wholesome for people to eat. And, in a lot of small ways, communities are finding ways to make this happen, whether it's, including some sort of fresh, wholesome food distribution with the WIC program for, women who are pregnant or who have small children, or whether it's accepting food stamps at farmers markets. I mean, there are things that activists in different localities are doing to try to make better quality food available, to people who don't have a ton of disposable income. Mm. So I just wanted to, put that out there. And I know that, around the Bay Area, there are some really exciting food justice programs. And, the one that I find really exciting is the People's Grocery in West Oakland.
Mm.
And, basically they're taking a community that doesn't even have supermarkets, where, the accessible places to buy food are in convenience stores. And if you've ever noticed, convenience stores don't have any fresh food. They sell, bags of potato chips and, things that aren't perishable. So the People's Grocery Store has created a mobile grocery to, go around. around in underserved neighborhoods and try to make wholesome food available at reasonable prices. So I just wanted to throw those things out there.
Great. Thank you for that.
So you did a lot of this cool research when you were writing your book, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was really all inspired by people I was meeting. But then after I'd meet people, I would, get on the Internet and do research. And I've subscribed to a lot of listserv, community food security, things like that. And, there's really... I mean, I feel like there's so much depressing information about our food system, whether it's the fact that, cloned animals are entering, have entered the market, or, the latest thing that I heard was ideas about early onset Alzheimer's being related to... food issues. So, there's so many very depressing ideas about the food system, but, I feel like, I want to focus on positive things that people can do and, activist projects that people can get involved with to, rather than just being fearful about all of the, awful facts of the mainstream food system, to put our energy instead into creating better alternatives.
I couldn't agree more.
We can be healthy,
absolutely.
And our communities can be healthy.
And I think to a degree, there seem to be murmurs, pretty much all throughout the country that, people are actually starting to pick up, and take notice of all these things. I mean, the facts are undeniable. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're Republican, Democrat, left-wing, Buddhist, whatever. I mean, these facts are undeniable, and it does seem like people are really starting to ask a lot of questions at the very least. What can I do to, to not, necessarily overhaul the whole system, but what can I do to make it better for myself and my family, and, to give farmers around me a fighting chance? I mean, farming used to be a much more profitable, highly respected trade in this country. It was kind of, could be argued that this country was kind of built on farming.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like a lot of times they're held hostage by, bills from Congress and by the corporations that pay for them.
Yes. And if you saw the future of food and how many commit suicide every year, it's really disturbing.
Yeah.
So
non-renewable seeds. And you're right. It's easy to get bogged down in all the negativity, but I think I completely agree. I think it's very important to, focus on the positive and try and get some inertia going. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's like we have the biggest weapon in the arsenal, which is our pocketbooks.
Money, absolutely.
And so that's really the way to get our voices heard. And there is a lot of distrust of corporations as well as government entities.
Mm-hmm.
The USDA, the FDA, these groups that don't appear to be having our best interests at heart. So the way to counter that is to basically just vote with our pocketbooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, opt out.
Take it.
Don't buy it.
Hands.
If you don't agree with something, don't buy it. And that's pretty much the strongest message you can send.
And they're getting the message, although they're still trying. Here Walmart's going to be selling organic. Now, of course, they're going to do their best to water down organics and make organic not really that great. But at the same time, it shows you what happens when people start buying all that, then other people start coming on board, other companies start coming on board and realizing, oh, that's what people want. So if we keep doing that more and more and not tolerate the watered down versions, and more people will change.
It's a trajectory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, there's organic milk in stores. And, I just wrote an article on Local Forage about Stonyfield Farm. They are what I thought was a fairly, respectable dairy.
Mm-hmm.
And they just recently signed a letter to the secretary of the USDA to basically not include this really critical ruling, which states that 30% of a cow's feed should come from pastured grass in order to be defined as being organic.
Right.
And so you would think that they would just sign this, and they didn't. They did not. They purposely excluded it, and they were on the same bill as Horizon and Aurora, which are huge factory organic farms.
I think that speaks to the participation that Sandor was talking about, because especially as you know, this movement does start taking hold and becomes, you know, starts becoming a little bit more present in people's consciousness, you know, these bigger companies are going to take notice, and what they're going to try and do is co-opt the term so that they can be a part of it. You know, it's going to require research and effort on people, mm-hmm. on behalf of people to,
yeah, we
to
can't
find
be asleep
out.
Anymore.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's going to require some effort, but I think the payoffs are going to be huge. And, the consequences of not paying attention and not acting are too dire, I mm-hmm. think.
And I think ultimately that's really good, because it's like, why should you give up your responsibility for your own health and well-being
Absolutely.
To someone else?
Right. And I never understand when people say it's just food. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just you know, like it's fuel you put in a gas tank. It's,
right.
It's you know, it's something you do 3 times a day. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that all has to be like, you know, haute cuisine or anything like that. But I mean, I think that the expectation that it be at the very least not bad for you.
Yes.
I don't think that's asking too much.
No, yeah. No. It's interesting, because I see all the time in my practice when I do educate people on the dangers of things like MSG and these artificial ingredients and the nitrates and all this stuff causing cancer and, you know, influencing brain chemistry and all these things. When people start to get that and then start eating this healthier way, mm-hmm. I have never found a person that didn't go, wow, this is delicious. This is far better than I thought. And people mm-hmm. a lot of times think health food, you know, tastes like cardboard. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the difference between an organic tomato or an organic peach? I mean, the flavor is unbelievably different.
Or that by definition you're an elitist by thinking that these are important things.
Right,
or
right.
It's that's far from the case.
And I think that, you know, just to bring this back to slow food, what we started talking about, I feel like one of the really great contributions of the slow food movement is reminding people that, you know, food is a source of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And eating well and eating healthy food, you know, is not punishment. Good food is not, you know, less delicious than junk food.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we have to remember that and celebrate that. And it's not about telling people what they should be eating, but it's about enticing people with the possibilities of how good their food could taste and make them feel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about some traditional foods, and maybe one of my biggest pet peeves is when I hear that, you know, we make all sorts of fermented foods, kombucha and sauerkraut and kefir and all sorts of things, and I always hear people say, well, I saw online, or I heard, or my doctor said, well, it's okay to have some of those, but don't make them at home yourself, because you could, whatever, I don't even know what their reasoning is. You could die, you could make toxic bacteria, you could do all these, and it makes me so angry, because, you know, it's just trying to take the power away from the people. And we've done this for, like Carla was saying, for generations and generations, and so I'd love for you, Sandor, to talk a little bit about some of these fermentation methods and maybe demystify a little bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, I want people to, you know, understand that fermentation is really, really safe. You know, okay, so ferment. We'll talk primarily about fermenting vegetables. I think, you know, fermenting meat is more complex, and there are more possibilities of problems, and you really do need to sort of like, you know, do some reading and some studying.
Hence the reason we have Taylor.
You know, I have, in my new book, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, I tried to distill sort of the key information about fermenting vegetables, and I posted it on my website, to wildfermentation.com, and it's called Vegetable Fermentation Further Simplified, and it's about a page and a half. The essential thing is you have to get your vegetables submerged under liquid. I'm sure we've all had the experience of leaving some vegetable in the pantry or something, going away on vacation, coming home 2 weeks later to discover that, no, it did not turn itself into sauerkraut, but rather it, you know, grew ugly dark molds. And if we went away for long enough, maybe those ugly dark molds reduced it to a puddle of slime on the counter.
Delicious.
What fermentation is about is learning the conditions under which favorable microorganisms will become dominant in a system. And for fermenting vegetables, the simple key is to make sure that the vegetables are submerged under water. Typically, you don't even need to add water. You add salt, and salt pulls the water out of the vegetables. And then you use some sort of force, you know, your hands, a tool, a weight bearing down vegetables, and then you have a brine protecting the vegetables and guaranteeing that souring bacteria that are present everywhere are what will grow. And it's actually incredibly safe and incredibly easy.
And the difference between, I'm sorry, just let me interject, the difference between store-bought sauerkraut and homemade, the difference is night and day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's not the same.
And fermentation is really key for all sorts of foods, but it pre-digests the foods, so it makes the nutrients that are present in the foods more accessible to our bodies, and particularly the minerals. You know, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has made it a project to promote fermentation in food-scarce regions of the world because, you know, if it's cassava roots or some, you know, other starchy tuber that are the primary thing that people have access to every day, they can get a lot more nutrition out of it if it's been fermented than if it hasn't. And you can generalize about foods that the fermentation pre-digests them and makes the nutrients in them more accessible. The fermentation also creates additional nutrients, and ferments are especially rich in B vitamins, and every ferment has some sort of unique micronutrients that are really only present in the fermented food. So, like fermented cabbage, sauerkraut has isothiocyanates, which are known to be an anti-carcinogenic compound, which are not found in the raw cabbage. Or miso has a compound. Miso is fermented soybean paste, most often made into a soup in Japanese cuisine, but it can be eaten in many different ways. And miso has a unique compound in it that's known as dipicolinic acid. And dipicolinic acid is like a magnet for radioactivity, and it literally draws radioactive substances out of your blood and out of your body. So, you know, each ferment has some real unique micronutrients, and fermentation is also the only method of preservation known to humans that does not diminish the nutrients in the food. Canned foods, dried foods, frozen foods, that all involves a diminishment of nutrients that is not found with fermented foods.
Well, and it's so dynamic. I remember you saying this at one of your lectures that when you are fermenting sauerkraut, that it's good to eat it, throughout the fermentation process because you're getting different bacteria at each stage. I always thought that was so cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, the technique of it is incredibly simple, but then what happens is very complex. It's like the life of a forest. You have all of these successions of species that, each species of bacteria that comes into dominance changes the pH and the other conditions and ultimately sows the seeds of their own demise and gives rise to the next generation of bacteria which succeeded. But acidic foods are really safe. None of the food poisoning organisms that you have ever heard the name of, botulism, E. coli, salmonella, listeria. The place where they can't survive is an acidic environment. So your acidic fermented foods actually are extremely safe.
Thank you for that, because I think firstly, they taste delicious. They're so easy to make. They're so healthy, great for digestion. And it always frustrates me that then the caveat is yes, but don't do them yourself. And if you don't do them yourself, if you're not fortunate enough to come from somewhere like the Bay Area, you probably are not going to find a raw sauerkraut on the shelf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's pasteurized, right, Sandor, all the stuff that's at the store?
Yeah, actually the two nationally distributed brands of sauerkraut which are sold alive come from the Bay Area. There's Rejuvenative Foods in Santa Cruz and Bubby's in San Francisco. It's absurd to, ship a food like that all around the country, and it's an ideal cottage industry for people to start as a small business, and there are a number of thriving small businesses in the Bay Area producing wonderful vegetable ferments.
We're planning on incorporating a lot of that into our new storefront when we move into our new store. We're
Berkeley?
No, it's going to be in Napa, actually,
oh,
at the Oxbow building right next to Copia.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
But my buddy Chuck, our other production head, hi, Chuck, mm-hmm. he gave me a pickling crock for Christmas, and so we've been tweaking our sauerkraut recipe.
Mm.
And, you know, it's been a lot of fun, and it is. It really is incredibly easy, and it's really satisfying, too. To watch something that you know, all you need is a knife, a cutting board, a crock, and some salt.
I know.
You know, weight it down, and you're off to the races.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It seems like the commercial markets are catching on a bit. You see a lot of the really high probiotic yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think, Sandor, that will create more of a resurgence of fermented foods, just this kind of consciousness around cultures?
Well, I mean, I feel like that's happening. I think that just a lot more people are. I mean, first of all, you used the word probiotics. That word has entered the biography, the vernacular. People understand what that word
means.
Not
all bacteria is bad.
And that is the fastest growing segment of the nutritional supplement market.
Mm-hmm.
People are buying them. People are spending lots and lots of money on probiotic supplements, and the most expensive probiotic supplement is something that's called SBO, soil-based organism.
Oh, yeah.
So really, what I recommend to people is rather than spending $50 on a little jar of capsules that have soil organisms in them, grow some carrots or radishes, and then when you pick them, leave some of the dirt that clings to them on, and get your soil-based organisms that way. And in general, I think any nutrients that are available in capsule form, if you're willing to find the foods that have them, you can get far, far better quality nutrition from a whole food than you ever can from a capsule.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that cultured milks are a great way to get live cultures. Cultured vegetables are a great way to get live cultures. Cultured beans, foods like miso, are a great way to get live cultures. Kombucha, I think that there are a lot of really wonderful ways with food that we can get those cultures into our bodies, and I think more and more people are understanding that.
So wait, Sandor, going back to the carrots and radishes, so what you just mentioned is that there is dirt on them, and you could actually include a little. So what happens is that the bad bacteria is killed by the good bacteria, right? Because there's going to be a lot.
In terms of eating dirt, I would definitely recommend that people, exercise some caution on where they eat dirt from. You don't want to eat dirt from right around the drip line of a house that might have lead in it. You don't want to eat the dirt from a former industrial area or something like that. But, I think, we all eat dirt in the course of our lives, and there's even a word, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, geophagy, which describes people eating dirt. In certain cultures, it's something that, pregnant women do. It's definitely a source of nutrients, but it does require a certain exercise of judgment.
So maybe for now we will ferment our sauerkraut. Maybe leave the dirt for maybe after you do some more
advanced
research.
You have to be at advanced level to ferment dirt, Sandor.
Well, the nice thing about dirt and bacteria is, try as we might to avoid them, we always end up eating small amounts of them.
This is true.
And, let me just say more broadly that, our culture has this war against bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is, a sign of this is all the antibacterial cleansing products, the widespread use of antibiotic drugs. People sort of have this idea that bacteria in general are bad. Maybe there are some good ones, but most of them are bad. And I think that, we have to really... it's a really problematic way of thinking because bacteria are, first of all, they're our ancestors if you subscribe to theories of evolution. All forms of life stem from bacteria, and no other form of life has ever been able to thrive without bacteria. Bacteria are part of every physiological process in our bodies, and, if you count the number of cells in your body that actually reflect your DNA... And then you count all the cells that are present that have nothing to do with your DNA. Each of our bodies is composed of 10 times as many independent cells that don't reflect our DNA, that are bacteria and other types of organisms that are that our bodies are host to, and which, you know, enable us to exist in the world. So, you know, bacteria are our allies. They're our ancestors. They can't be our enemies. And the vast majority of them, which are harmless to us, actually help protect us from the ones that have the potential to make us sick.
Yeah, I am a huge fan in my practice of fermented foods. They not only help with digestion, but immune function and getting rid of toxins and all sorts of amazing things. And I think it's the one thing in our culture that's really missing, because we like everything sweet and fermented foods are all sour. And so it's not something that normally is in there unless we go out of our way to consume them. So we have only a couple minutes left, and I want to just have everybody go ahead and give their contact information and how to get a hold of them. And if there's anything in particular that they want, that you want to say, I love this show because we talked a lot about all the wonderful positive things instead of all the scary things. So if in your closing comment, we have to finish up literally in about 2 minutes. So if there's any closing comment of anything positive people can do or anything, and I'll start with you, Sandor.
Well, I mean, I just want to thank you for having me on the show. Remind people about my website, which is wildfermentation.com. And I also just want to, as a parting thought, you know, I think that, you know, consumer action is a powerful thing. However, I want to encourage people to break out of that identity of consumer. We are all more than consumers. And, you know, more of us, most of us, need to become involved in some aspect of food production. It's not about everyone, each of us being self-sufficient, but it's about more of us contributing to the creation of good food choices for everybody.
Thank you, Sandor.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Okay, Taylor.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's very important that people get involved and you know, ask questions. You know, find out about these things. The information's there. It's just not gonna, it's not gonna drop from the sky into your lap. I think that, yeah, wow, well put. I really have nothing to follow it up with. Thank you so much for having me on, Julie.
Absolutely. And people can find you at fattedcalf.com.
That's correct.
And then when is your new store coming?
Hopefully in September.
Ooh.
We've had a couple setbacks, but we'll be putting updates on the website as they occur.
That sounds great. And in the meantime, people can go to the San Francisco Farmers Market or the Berkeley Farmers Market.
That's correct. Every Saturday.
All right. Mm-hmm. Great.
And they can call in their orders, too.
Yes, yep. Which we always do because they run out of crepinettes, so you want to get there earlier, place
right.
an order.
Oh, Julie, you shouldn't tell people.
Oh, I know.
Well, it does, you know, these things are made to be sold and, you know, remade every week. So, so yeah, if you want something, make sure you get on there and let us know.
Great.
We'll have it waiting for you.
Thanks, Taylor.
Thank you.
And Carla?
I would have to say that my motto is delicious food, eating delicious food and healthy food are not mutually exclusive.
Hmm.
So that's what Local Forage is all about, traditional foods, healthy foods. And I've documented my escapades into fermentation thanks to Sandor and his guidance. And there's also at least a couple of odes to the fatted calf, some love poetry for Taylor's sausages and pâtés and crepinettes.
All right.
So that's Local Forage, localforage.com.
And I'm Julie Matthews, and Carla is my cooking buddy, and we make lots of fun creations all the time, and hopefully we'll do something with Taylor's Crepine one of these days and play around with that. Yeah. And you can find out more about me at healthfulliving.org, and you can listen to this show and share it with any of your friends at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned every Thursday at noon for Reality Sandwich. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Reality Sandwich on 89.5 KPOO, San Francisco. This show and any past shows of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com, where you can also read about upcoming shows. To learn more about Julie Matthews or Martin Matthews, go to healthfulliving.org. Thanks for listening.